Hello, hello.
How's everybody?
Good, you're the first one on.
All right. Extra points for that.
That's right.
How's the house coming along?
All right, this is Iacocca teleclass number 4 of Q2. I've got Steve, Paul, and Peter on the call with Jeff so far.
Yeah, Ramon.
Did I miss anybody?
Ramon texted in last night. His wife had an emergency he had to address, so he asked if he could catch up on the telephone.
Okay.
Someone else is joined.
Hello?
Did you just join?
Hey, guys. Yeah. Morning, guys.
Morning. So, let's start out like we usually do. Any wins to speak of? Any challenges to work through?
I'll start. Jeff and I had real good success with the roadmap. We've been... threw the first draft up about a month ago, and we've been speaking about it and batting it back and forth. And then this past week, Jeff really tied the roadmap into the strategy and brought a lot of clarity to the team, certainly to me, for the rest of this year. We shortened the term we just looked at Q3 and Q4 and a little bit of Q1 next year. So we didn't go, my roadmap went out here, and then Jeff drilled down to just the next 6 months, very detailed. So I think it was a huge win.
Nice. Nice. And so
the 5-10 plate's been also really helpful.
Who just joined the call?
Oh, it's Brandy. I accidentally dialed into our other line for a minute and realized I was alone, so.
Gotcha. Welcome. We're just talking about wins. Anybody else have any wins or challenges of note?
This is Peter. I'm pretty new to the 5 minutes of prep, but I feel like there's been a couple of situations where it's been pretty effective and useful for me. Yesterday was the first time for our weekly game filming, not weekly game filming, our weekly meeting. I had done some 5 minutes of prep on Monday. It was actually 10 minutes, but, you know, all the same. And I just felt much more prepared for the meeting. It wasn't like I talked a whole lot, but, you know, I was just much more prepared for the meeting. I felt like if there were going to be any questions, I was going to be prepared for them. You know, and I could tell everybody else was pretty prepared for the meeting as well. Sometimes it's a little easier when you sell almost 70 cars, but, you know, just taking that 5 to 10 minutes the day before it makes all the difference in how you show up. You just feel so much more prepared about what you're going to do during that meeting.
Nice. Yeah, it's surprising how much just even 5 minutes sort of makes. I was thinking about...
You just show up so much better when you do it.
Yeah. That's great.
Hey.
I'm glad to hear the practice
hey
work.
This is Vance. I mean, I'm pretty much the same as Peter, but I'll tell you this. I mean, it's kind of taken effect in, I mean, every part of my day-to-day life, whether it's at home, at work, before work, just having that preparation. I mean, it's been really key for me. I take a lot of time before I come into work on, you know, trying to really decide what I'm going to do that day and just get my day set up. With the preparation and know what I'm going to execute before meetings, it's gone great. and even going down to smaller conversations I have with either customers or just some of the CEOs in the environment, or just you know, the people in the environment with, you know, conflicts or just issues that arise. Having that 5 minute prep has just been, I mean, just really, really changing the outcome of every situation that I'm going through, and that's really good, just because I'm focusing on the outcome that I desire. So it's been pretty good for me too.
Nice.
And this is Brandy. Just to echo, Vance said it at home and work. I have used that 5 minutes of prep, I mean, just to get on regular vendor phone calls now. And maybe it's only taken me like 2 to 3 minutes, you know, but like to get on a Vin Solutions phone call. But I've also used the 5 minutes of prep to get on a phone call with my aunt because I needed it really bad. So it has been, I have used that probably, I would say, 10 times in the last 2 weeks, and found it to be just my mental state going into whatever I'm about to do feels much more creator, because I feel like I've prepared myself to go in and be proactive and instead of just reactive. So I really, really love that simple exercise.
Nice. Very nice. All right. Well, I appreciate you guys throwing out some of those wins. Just a quick check-in. How are the weekly practices and implementation plan coming? You guys keeping up with that?
Yeah, your implementation plan's going well. Practices are still kind of sporadic, but you know, I think as a team, we're doing much more of it. But I wouldn't say that I'm where I want to be, because the practices, I don't necessarily plan out the practices as much as I should, and it hasn't necessarily become a daily or weekly rhythm yet. But certainly, we're all making progress.
Nice. So I guess as a challenge to that, what's just one practice you can actually schedule with yourself as a time block that you feel like, I mean, and again, not to put you on the spot, but I would be inauthentic if I was going to let that go without maybe a challenge to do something different with how you plan it.
To schedule it and make it a priority, just like anything else that we do. You know, just like we, you know, schedule a time out to do the readings and schedule time to do weekly game filming. It's also important to schedule the time to do the practices, because just like, you know, when I first started the weekly, that was kind of tough. It was kind of strange. I wasn't really comfortable with it. But I continue to schedule it, and now it's just a normal routine. So it's just, I've just got to make it a priority and basically find a partner that I can commit to and that can commit to me. And I think if I find somebody that I just point to and say, hey, we're gonna hold each other accountable, I think that'll make it much easier, opposed to each individual trying to put it on themselves. I think we're more likely to commit to somebody else because we don't want to let them down.
Yeah, no, that's actually...
We should probably find a partner that we can just rely on and say, this time, for 10 to 15 minutes, we will both be committed to each other. That way you're not, you know, if you fail in that commitment, you're not just failing yourself, you're failing another person too. So that might make it a little easier for us to commit to practicing consistently.
I love it. I love the accountability of your executive team, right? I mean, that accountability is it's not a new concept, and it's something that works, and I'm always shocked why more people don't do it, not necessarily only in the professional context of some of this kind of stuff, but even just like, you know, hey, I want to go to the gym every day. Well, going to the gym every day is really easy when you have to pay somebody and you lose it if you don't, or if you have to show up for a buddy and you don't want to let them down, right? So Would it be fair to say by the end of this week, which gives you a couple days, you would have identified an accountability partner, whoever that may be, whether it's on the team or not, and have maybe tried to just hold one practice, one additional practice, or one new practice, or maybe it's just one practice you're not doing, and just report back how that goes. That's all I'm asking.
I'm going to commit to reaching out to the group and finding an individual that I can commit to.
Awesome.
By the end of this week, I'll talk with somebody, and we'll get it going.
Great. So by 5 p.m. Friday, would you mind just posting, hey, I reached out, here's my accountability partner, here's the thing I'm signing up to do?
Yeah, by 5 p.m. Friday, I'll have that out.
Awesome. I appreciate that. And, you know, hey, no good deed goes unpunished, so I appreciate you putting yourself out there.
Ruth, speaking of the listserv, that is one thing I've fallen down on, and I really, with every intention when we started out this quarter, was like, I'm going to post. I know I even had the conversation in one of these meetings or in our all-day meeting where I said, you know, I overthink whether what I have to post is of value to others, and then sometimes end up not posting it, like it's not that big of a deal. But I want to make a, you know, and I love seeing when other people, even if they failed and they only, you know, when Eric Ray was here, sometimes he'd just send one or two sentences. And I think, like, in my head, I think I need to have, like, some nugget of gold in order to post. And just seeing, you know, Steve posts the most regularly, like, just seeing that reminder that someone went on there and tried something, or it's something that they came in encounter with on their day-to-day, you know, came back to something we're working on, is really encouraging. And I feel like I need to recommit to not overthinking and knowing that my lessons can be of value, and maybe they're only of value to me for putting them down, but I'd like to see more on our group, and I know it needs to start with me. You know, just because we don't have the time to really, except for right here, to share the wins, but obviously there are wins, you know.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, one of the Sagan coaches here calls it the burden of significance. Right? Not everything you have to say, not everything you write has to be the world's most earth-shattering significant thing. But the fact that you share it will have significance in some way. And it oftentimes holds you back, right? So I think I share a lot of those traits when I tend to do a lot of e-journal stuff, especially when I went to the IOP, which was, you know, I had to edit and I had to continually sort of rework it until I put it out there for fear that what I put out there maybe wasn't going to be received well or wasn't important enough or whatever it is. And I think what you said is pretty important, which is just post it. People will find something in it, right? And
right.
Steve, you've done a pretty good job of this over the course of multiple Sagan courses. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yes, I'd love to hear how he puts time away. What makes him decide to post?
I just set up two time blocks in my calendar, and, you know, I just come to treat them just like, it starts with the mindset that the appointment with yourself is as important as any other appointment you have for the week. And the more you can really lock that in and place higher importance on yourself, the easier it is. So what I do is I have two advanced executions. They're 45-minute time blocks, and then inside my calendar, I list out at the beginning of the week what I'm going to do in those time blocks. So one of those time blocks might be post a journal and work on dynamic its agenda. Another one might be review the structural meeting format and read the Escaping the Drama Triangle article. So I'll make it more specific. What I found when I just put in advance, whether it's I was the ILP warranty or advanced execution, when I just put the time block in but didn't have any clarity of what I was going to do in that 45 minutes, I was more likely to move the meeting. And now when I put the specific things I'm going to work on inside the time block, it actually becomes a more committed meeting. And then the other thing is make sure you pick the time where you know you're going to be most likely to be free. Because if you just, I found in the beginning, I would just look at my calendar and just plug it in anywhere that was open, but often that time would get filled. So what I found is that there's certain days and certain times of the week that are usually open more likely, and that's when I plug them in.
Nice. That's great.
You know, it's interesting, right? Because if you want to go deeper on this, one of the things you want to think about is what's your competing commitment? And it's, you know, it's a reflection, right? But ultimately, when I struggle to post things and I do this thing where I have to edit and I have to make sure it's significant, et cetera, ultimately I believe, and, you know, it's probably a work in progress, but ultimately I believe that the competing commitment is for me to show up a certain way versus being vulnerable that my ideas get out there regardless of how I think someone might perceive them. Not the actual perception, but how I think they might perceive them. And so the competing commitment here is to maintain some sort of, you know, image or sort of validation and not put that validation at risk by putting something out there that I haven't worked on significantly. But ultimately that stops me from posting like I want, right?
Right.
So, something to reflect on, but at least the framework of competing commitments will start to help you unpack that a little bit more.
I think the other challenge, Root, too, is I find the e-journals work better when there's people from outside various organizations. The fact that we're all here every day colliding with one another, having conversations with one another, it's a little bit awkward to post something on the e-journal as opposed to having the conversation. So we ran into that with HPP, where people didn't really want to post on the e-journal. So what we did instead is we would set up reoccurring breakfast meetings where instead of posting, we as a HPP group would meet and we would just talk about the, you know, what we would normally post on the journal. And that seemed to be very well attended. I mean, we'd have 13, 14, 15 people show up for breakfast out of the group of 20, 21 to share their experiences. So, just recognizing that challenge. But
yeah, absolutely. I think that's actually a really good point, which is the venue may not be appropriate given the interactions that you guys have every day. Okay. Well, if everybody's good, I'd love to shift over to the topic of the day. And part of this was talking about productive conflict and then telling ourselves a story, which I think oftentimes are intimately related. But can anybody walk me through what the four stages of the productive conflict cycle are? And once again, not all at once, because it makes it really hard to understand who's speaking when you guys all start to talk over each other.
Awareness, assessment, action, and learning.
Excellent. And on that sheet that you're reading from, what are the key questions that go with those?
Where is the group emotionally? Are all perspectives visible? What is the nature of any conflict arising? Are we processing it skillfully or getting off track? What tool or practice might shift the group toward more productive interaction? What would be a better next action choice?
I like it. So if we take that frame, awareness, assessment, action, and learning, right? and start to put it up against our practices and our tools, what are some corresponding practices? What's a corresponding practice for awareness?
Would that be the council?
No, but good try. I wanted to have more awareness. What practice do I have available to me that I could use?
Recalibration.
That's one, possibly, yep. Another one? And it's part of what I'm going for here.
Facts versus perception?
Possibly the next one, but again, nice try.
How about listening?
Listening is certainly a component of it. What I was going with was Bisbee. So, focus, interstate, and behavior, right? And what I'm ultimately trying to get towards is a key question is, what's my internal state? How do I have awareness if I don't know what my internal state is? And how do I get to my internal state? I go through the Bisbee process. What am I focusing on? What's interstate being created as a result of that? What behavior am I displaying because of that interstate? Does that make sense?
Yes.
So then, if we shift to the next part of the cycle, which is assessment, what's a practice or tool we could be using for assessment? So, I've gone through the process of figuring out how I'm feeling. What's the next thing? What's the next tool that I can use?
Ladder of inference.
That's one, yep, absolutely. Can you break down the ladder of inference for me?
I'll try. It starts with what facts are you choosing to notice or draw on, and from that, you make certain assumptions about the limited set of facts that you draw on, and then from that set of assumptions, you start to draw conclusions as to what those assumptions mean. Those conclusions lead up to beliefs that you have formed over the years based on your experiences and values and relationships. And then those beliefs lead you to take a certain action, and you go up and down the ladder pretty quickly and many times unconsciously. And it happens all the time and at a very rapid pace. And that's where the telling ourselves stories forms.
Absolutely. It happens within a split second. You don't even realize that you've gone up the ladder and you're adopting a certain way of doing something, right? So I've created this sort of internal state, understand how I'm feeling. Now I have this observable event, and I've kind of followed it all the way up to some sort of action that I've taken based on that observable event by the facts that I've basically chosen or selected to help reinforce what I want. What's another tool or practice for this assessment?
The drama triangle?
Yeah, that kind of reflection sort of reinforces the Bisbee outcome. How about telling ourselves a story? Right? This check-in, this format, this tool of basically telling ourselves a story of what's happening versus what's actually happening, and checking in with the individual often helps create an assessment of what's actually going to happen, right? So if you have telling ourselves a story and ladder of inference as the practice or tool, what's the key question that comes out of that leads you to the next step? What's the key thing you need to ask yourself in stage two, assessment?
What's actually going on?
Yep, it's very drama triangle-esque, right? What orientation am I in? What's actually happening? Am I helping or am I hurting? So I've got a focus on an interstate, creating a behavior. I assess that by a ladder of inference, breaking it down into what actually happened, what am I going up on that ladder, or I create sort of this telling myself a story situation. But ultimately, I've got to get towards what frame am I coming from, right? What would the third actual stage in the of this cycle is action, right? So I've got awareness. I figured out what's happening. Now I've got action. What are some practice or tools that you can use for action? One of these is my absolute favorite.
Redirecting energy.
Redirecting energy, yeah, possibly. Absolutely.
Framing.
What's another one? Say it.
Framing.
Framing, absolutely.
Inquiry over advocacy.
Yep. Coaching and challenging. Inquiry and advocacy. What else?
My favorite, doing nothing.
Exactly.
Yes.
That's my favorite as well. Let's take a pause there. Because I love doing nothing, and it's mostly misunderstood, right? But I think it's really powerful. Talk to me about why it's your favorite first, and I want to jump into it a little bit more.
Well, I was being a bit of a dick, but it is important, and it's probably the hardest to understand, especially when you feel like you're getting pressure to do something. Sometimes the most important thing you can do is just be a great active listener, really look at the entire situation, take in all the pertinent facts that you need, and just do nothing until it makes sense to take action. So that just means understanding the situation fully before just taking an action just to take action. Sometimes what we do is, you know, we have pressure to make something happen, so we just kind of wing it and try to do something just to show we're trying to solve a problem. But in effect, we'll really just create other problems because we didn't fully think through the situation that we're in. And if we would have just taken time to just reflect on the situation and not act, we probably would come out with a better solution if we just took the time to think about what's going on.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that oftentimes we feel the burden of having to do something or to rescue or to act quickly. And generally speaking, you can absolutely do nothing and things will get resolved by themselves. Not all the time. But in certain situations, that actually works really well. Oftentimes in coaching, when you do nothing and you watch and observe and you let people struggle and figure out, which is really hard to do, because you want to just jump in and almost rescue them, but if you actually can sit there and stomach the pain of having watched them figure it out themselves, the impact goes much further, right? And doing nothing doesn't mean not being engaged. It's actually the opposite. It's being engaged in an authentic way, but not having to carry the burden for someone to figure out their situation or to figure out a situation. Any other tools that are available to us as action choices?
Cooling and heating conflict.
Yep. If it's passive, heat it up, and if it's hot, bring it down a little bit. Allow people to start to resolve this. What's another one?
Deciding.
Sometimes you guys, as leaders, have to just make a call. And that's okay, too. You leverage your experience, you listen to the facts, you hear everybody out, and you just make a call. And you got to use that judiciously, right? Because you don't want to, you know, sort of take, you don't want your teams to think that they will never be able to control an outcome. But when you have a genuine sort of gridlock and a genuine back and forth on the executive team or within your own teams, making a decision is absolutely available to you as a choice. What's the question, the key question you have to ask yourself when you're in the action stage?
How can I be most helpful?
There it is. How can I be most helpful? That's an orientation in and of itself, right?
Yes.
Okay, then finally, the learning stage. What's key practice or tool?
Game filming?
That's right. You guys see us do it every time after the quarter, right, with 2x2. You game film what happens. Figure out what choices you need to make differently. Figure out what were some of the lessons we learned. What are the things we could have done better, right? What's the key question that comes from learning? Or what's the key question you want to ask yourself?
Did my choice work?
Yeah. How often, I mean, this is somewhat facetious and somewhat not, but how often have you guys found yourself in a personal dynamic where you've had some productive conflict, et cetera, and you've conscientiously chosen a path, and then you look back and said, did that come out like I thought it would or not?
All the time.
It happens all the time.
Yeah?
It's usually the wrong decision.
Right. There's some form of game filming, but ultimately it's embedded in your process, right? I mean, at least for me, when I go through these kind of things, I start to realize a lot of my productive conflicts are not, they're not even productive, they're just conflicts, and I'm being reactive. And all we're trying to do is shift it to a proactive way, and then learn from what choices we made, right? With more choices comes more awareness, and with more awareness, you have an ability to impact outcomes. Something to think about as a reinforcing cycle. So, going over to telling ourselves a story, who can sort of give me a rundown of the practice of telling ourselves a story and how you'd approach it?
If there's a situation that arises where information has been communicated to you, and if you at any point don't feel confident in what you're hearing, or maybe it seems odd, the best way to get clarity is to approach the person and literally just say, the story I'm telling myself is such and such. And what this will do is basically, it puts the burden on you instead of the other person. You're saying, hey, you know, this is what I heard. I don't know if this is what you meant, but, you know, I think I probably misunderstood. Could you just clarify? And that approach basically will give the person, basically who's the archer, whoever's the messenger, that will give them a chance to hit the bullseye. Again, without feeling like they're being attacked or questioned, really. You're putting the onus on yourself and saying, hey, I think I probably misunderstood the situation.
Yep.
So I think in that situation, you're able to get a lot more clarity and honesty. You're not attacking a person. You're putting the responsibility on yourself, opposed to putting the responsibility on someone else. And that way, you're more likely to get the honesty behind what's really going on.
Yeah, absolutely. Question I have, has anybody actually used it telling ourselves a story in their personal life?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
How's that worked out for you?
It's good. I've used it a couple of times with my wife, and she's Italian, so she's a little feisty. So you have to be pretty ready to tell yourself a story, and it's really several times has kind of, you know, calmed the situation down without, you know, making her feel uncomfortable. And it really solves situations a lot quicker, you know, because you basically put any responsibility on yourself and you can kind of manage that because you're aware of what you're trying to do. Opposed to saying, hey, you did this, you did that. You know, you switch the script and say, hey, this is what I'm seeing. This is my understanding. I may be incorrect. And then that gives, you know, would give her an opportunity to correct what she's saying and but feel as though she's not necessarily wrong. So
yep. That's
where it helps.
I feel like it really worked. It has worked very well between, I know I posted like a pretty personal story probably about a month and a half ago about my husband and I with that, but we're very, very different people with very different motivations for why we do things. And so if I, in my head, put any reasoning why, you know, if I try to apply my reasoning for doing things to the way Chad does them, I am definitely going to be telling myself a story, you know, and we've had that gridlock in certain things for years, you know. And so the couple times that we've had really big breakthroughs have been for me to sit down and me not applying my filter of why I would do or not do things to him and sitting down and checking in with him and letting him know what I, you know, where my mind goes, but that I realize is the story I'm telling myself. And having that out of the way has given him the space to give me the real story, you know, and it's funny because, you know, we just have very, very, very different, you know, motivators, and it has really helped me understand that I cannot apply my way of thinking to why he, you know, I have to know, it works out much better if I know exactly where he's coming from.
Yep.
And don't apply the way I would think to it.
No, great. Does everybody have access, or do they know they have access to the worksheet, the telling ourselves a story worksheet? Does anybody have that handy?
I've got the practices on my desktop. Or all the worksheets on my desktop.
Okay. What I want you guys to do at some point is use that worksheet, right? It's not a weekly practice, but it is one of the assignments in a kind of a loose way, which is work on the actual practice of telling ourselves a story and then post an insight. This worksheet's actually really, really helpful, and the way it works from the bottom up is you're just filling in boxes, right? But I'd love to hear some comments over the next several weeks about sort of how the telling ourselves a story worksheet helps you break down some of these things and what impact it might or might not have had in a more explicit way. But it starts with just, I'm noticing, right? What are the facts of the situation? And then I'm assuming this means. So to Steve's point, facts of the situation, observable. I'm assuming this means now I'm starting to select things and create some sort of, you know, understanding of it. Conclusion I'm drawing is the next step, and you're moving bottom up, right, because you're going up the ladder as part of the telling ourselves a story. But the conclusion I'm going to draw is whatever it may be, and then finally the belief I'm going to adopt as a result of that conclusion is this, and then the action I intend to take as a result of that actual belief. That's going up the ladder, right? And then the next stage or the next process is just doing a check-in with the person and writing down some notes on how you actually checked in. And then the final part, we have a new story box, which is basically leaving yourself some space to adjust the story you were previously telling versus what actually happened post-check-in. It's an incredibly useful tool, if you're open to it, to do the game filming and actually work through the telling ourselves a story practice. Because it's one of those things that this practice in particular lends itself very well to sort of internal reflection without explicit output, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And so I'd love to just see over the next 2 weeks, which is well within a reasonable time frame for the assignment even, Just break down one situation. Of telling myself a story, or telling ourselves a story, and how it might impact as you work through it. Does that seem reasonable?
Yeah.
Okay, great. All right. So, you know, jumping into some of the productive conflict key action choices, one of the things, we kind of went deeper into doing nothing, but can anybody break down any of the other actual practices? And the things you have to choose from are framing, inquiry versus advocacy, or, said differently, coaching versus challenging, feedback. And what's the process for feedback, right? Deciding or cooling and heating conflict. Any one of those, can I get just experience or a breakdown or some further expansion of those tools and practices or those key action choices?
Hey, Rubens, Jeremy. I'll take inquiry. I think that's something that I try to use often when there's some conflict going on. I can, you know, ask a lot of questions, try to learn, you know, and help people understand that I'm coming at it from a position that, you know, I'm trying to learn, I'm trying to help resolve. And so start out by asking a lot of good questions and see what's happening with the participants in the conflict and see if they can kind of work down a path to unfold, you know, without it heating up too much. So, you have to really be careful when you're asking the right questions and actively listening and kind of filling out the participants in the conflict. But
yeah, absolutely. So, what do you think one of the key points is, or what are some of the things you found that help prevent inquiry from going awry on you? Because it could. It's somewhat risky if you don't come from the right orientation.
I think you have to, you know, you truly have to actively listen. You can't jump in, and you definitely can't, you know, act off your assumptions, or you have to ask a question and then make the other person feel that you truly are listening. And you want to hear, and you want the end result to be a resolution of the conflict. You also have to be careful not to ask, you know, loaded questions that, you know, you're not, you know, kind of, that you already know the answer to, you know, so
yep.
It can be a little slippery slope.
Yeah, for me, I found that the loaded questions part, the leading questions, leading them to an outcome that I want to have, is the trickiest part, because if I'm asking a question and I know the answer I want to get to, why am I even going down this process of actually having some genuine inquiry?
Right.
You know? It's funny. They talk about, like, teaching kids when they first start lying. Oftentimes parents, and I'm just reading this stuff because I've got an 11-month-old, right? And I'm sure those of you with kids who are older probably have seen this happen before, but one of the things when you first figure out that they're lying is you ask them, right? And so, if they took a cookie and you know they took a cookie and they're saying they didn't, generally the question is, did you take a cookie or not, right? And that's a fully loaded question because there's no real right answer there, right? Yes, I did and I get in trouble. No, I didn't and I'm lying. But that's an example of just a leading question where you're taking an outcome, right? I haven't quite fully figured out how to work through the whole lying thing with kids, but fortunately Archie's not there yet, so.
Practice on us, Ruth. If you're going to screw it up with us.
I appreciate that.
If you had a problem with your 11-month-old lying, I'd just be like, man, you are I don't even want to go down your path.
Yeah, no, we're well ahead of the curve in terms of just, you know, having to even deal with that, but it's something I find interesting to read, you know?
Prepare yourself, for sure.
So thanks for going deeper on inquiry. Who's got another practice or another action along the lines of productive team conflict that they find interesting, that they like to use, they haven't used before, but want to know more about, want to go deeper with in the group setting?
I'll make a stab at feedback. I recall from the ILP, it's practice of SBI, which is state the situation, then the behavior, and then the impact that it's having. When given feedback, try to avoid being accusatory or come across as a persecutor, but really, as much as possible, be objective. And I think you can use some inquiry too, but I think prior to it, but when you're ready to give the feedback, be very specific, as this is the situation that I want to talk about. And you know, it could be something as simple as, I noticed since we had a conversation 2 weeks ago about your tardiness that you've still been late 3 of the last 5 days, and you had reassured me that the situation would be handled. So the behavior is that you are continuing to not to show up and not address the situation and take ownership of your responsibility to be here on time. And the impact is you're on the morning shift and we have scheduled around consumers calling in for, and there's no one there to answer the phones. And so the impact is lost sales. And then I think you want to be able to explore with the person what they are willing to take ownership of and then agree on what the actions are going forward, and, as well as potential consequences.
Yep. Yeah, that's definitely a great breakdown of feedback, right? And one of the keys that we always speak to is making it non-attributive. What does that really mean, and what does that allow you to do for the individual?
Yeah, you don't want to attack their character or say, you know, you don't care, or you don't, you're just irresponsible. You want to avoid that. What you really want to do is focus on, like I said, the situation and the behavior and the impact that it's making, as opposed to trying to make the person feel that they're attacked, being attacked. And I think that it puts them in a different state where if they feel they're being attacked, you know, it goes into the whole fight or flight reactionary part, and that leads to a different conversation and can end up in the drama triangle. When you are just focused on the situation and the behavior and the impact, you're likely to end up in the empowerment dynamic.
Yeah, absolutely, right? So if you make it attributive, not only do I get defensive, but I don't have choices. You just told me I'm lazy. That's how I am. I have no other choice to make, right? But if you break it down with SBI, situation is you didn't make your bed. The behavior, you know, the situation is asked to make your bed. Behavior is you didn't make your bed. And the impact is it makes me believe that, A, you don't care about me or what I want, or B, you don't care about cleanliness, or C, whatever it is, right? In that situation, I at least have a choice that I can make, and I can come to a different outcome. But by going attributive, you just basically prescribe me as a certain way and no actual choice to make for you differently. And that's the real key.
Can you cover council mode and hot pole conflict?
Yeah, absolutely. So council mode, which is actually one of my favorites as well, goes into allowing a bunch of people to surface fairly controversial ideas or opinions without having to kind of go down areas or paths that either get it too heated or that are non-productive or don't allow you to see the full range of ideas or opinions that are available to you. So we've had a client, for instance, when making, as an executive team, when making the decision on cuts. The year didn't turn out the way they wanted it to. They had to make some cuts in some of the staff. And coming to that decision, they used council mode because they knew it was going to be emotionally charged. They knew it was going to be really tough to do. And ultimately, the owner of the business had to surface the right set of opinions from his executive team in a non-encumbered way. So what they did was they sat around a circle. Everybody got, in that situation, I think a minute and a half, maybe 2 minutes, to talk about what decision they were advocating for and why they thought it was the right decision. No one was allowed to respond to that actual person's comments. And it went all the way around with the owner of the business going last, with the ability to sort of hear everybody in a way that previously is not available to them, especially when you have dialogue that's that heated or that emotionally charged. Does that make sense?
Yeah, what was a little confusing was to me was the remind non-speakers to be in active listening mode only, and my interpretation of active listening was the practice that we've been going through, which is, you know, listening with questioning and empathy, and so I guess it's not, I just want to make sure it wasn't, you just let the person talk, state their point, and then no questions are asked. Then what happens after, so if there's a heated argument, things are getting intense, you call a timeout, say let's go into council mode, you know, Peter takes the floor, he has 1 to 5 minutes, depending on the topic, to express his opinion, no one asks questions or asks for clarity, and they just let him express, and then what happens?
Well, generally speaking, the whole team will do it, right? Not just one person, but the whole team will actually go around. You go to the next person, and they'll say something along those lines, et cetera. To your point about active listening, a lot of times we take the, I mean, even if we're not interacting with someone, we're listening to recharge the bullets, to load the gun and respond. So
right.
In this situation or example, Peter's got 1 to 5 minutes, he says a bunch of stuff, and rather than you actually listening to his opinion and what he has to say, you're simply taking his point by point and reloading against what you're going to say for that as reactions or responses, and then you use your time 1 to 5 minutes to just respond to him, right? That would not be a very good use of council mode, and that would not be active listening. Now, if he did the 1 to 5 minutes, next person, Brandy goes, 1 to 5 minutes, then Jeff, then Jeremy, then everybody else, right? Vance, et cetera. That's how it would typically work.
That's cool. Okay. That makes more sense. That's good. And then the heating versus cooling, or heating conflict, hot versus cold, just... is that just mirroring the, you know, when they're passive, what are some things you can do when the energy's dull to heat it up? And what, I guess when it's hot, council mode would be a one way of cooling, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So council mode is a great way to cool it. When it's hot, angry, challenging, things of that nature. So, I mean, 90% of heating and cooling conflict is really about actually just recognizing what kind of conflict you're in. Does that make sense? I mean, so one of the things we find is that if someone is in a passive sort of conflict, then a lot of times executive teams will just let that go, or the owner will just let that go, or the person who's impacted the most will just let it go. And oftentimes they'll even just retaliate in a passive way, right? And so all of the actual conflict goes into a very, very subversive and sort of underground space, even though it has actual external impact.
Yeah.
But at least recognizing, hey, we're in a cool conflict here. We're in a passive conflict that we need to work through. Help.
Got it. That's good. Well done. Thank you.
Yeah, no worries. Happy to help, and I love these questions. I mean, these are the stuff we need to continue to go deeper into, right? Any other questions as we're kind of right at the 5 minute mark right before we're supposed to conclude, and so if there's no other questions or no one wants to go into any of the other actual actions, then I'd love to hear some takeaways.
The one question I have, Roop, going back to like the council mode, is when in the example you gave about the people who had to make cuts, they actually used council mode before there was, so it can be used to preempt because you know something's emotionally charged or you know that people are going to have strong feelings about a subject, so you can open something with council mode in order to let that out.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great observation. It helps diffuse some of the energy that would otherwise go unproductively.
So it's basically just, you know, like using FISBE or something to know that there's going to be emotion around this, and let's go ahead and preempt that and use council mode to get that out so people aren't simmering on something emotional, and then that way you can have a productive, make correct decision after that and hopefully avoid, like, conflict under the surface.
Yeah, absolutely. So an example of that, right, is before you go into that meeting, you simply acknowledge, hey, we have some tough decisions to make, one way or another. Outcomes aren't made, conclusions aren't already drawn, right? But I do realize this is going to be emotionally charged and challenging for all of us to actually express. So what I'd like to do is start this meeting with council mode. I want to hear some major opinions from each one of you. And then at the end of council mode, what I'm going to do is take what you've all said and distill it into the two or three things that I think are the most important for us to focus on for the rest of the meeting, right? And so what you've done now is opened it up for everyone to both, A, emotionally put what they have to say out there, B, start to work towards or through what you think are the most important things, right? And you can even frame the council mode of, hey, I know we have to make this decision. I want to hear what you think are the two best or most important things we need to be focusing on for the rest of our time. Go. That's another way of doing it. And then actually using that as the rest of the platform for a meeting. I've seen people do that all the time. Now, another way that it goes down is, hey, we've had a whole hour-long meeting, and we haven't come to any conclusions, but we've surfaced a lot of stuff. And now I, as the leader, have to go back and make some decisions. And what I want to do is basically get the last final word from everyone so I can really understand their opinion and what's going on for them before I have to go and make this very, very tough decision. Right?
Okay.
So there's an example of it before or after.
Okay.
Hey, Roop,
that's
it's
really
Jeff.
Cool.
It occurs to me you said a couple of, actually one really, really important thing in both of those examples, and I wanted to just throw this out there, see what, if I'm thinking through this right. As a leader, if you use council mode, it occurred to me in the examples you used that you better be very clear about the next step, because it could be, and tell me if I'm wrong, that council mode could be an extremely, you know, negative tool. If you sort of say, oh, I will use this sexy council mode, use it, and then just plow on with the agenda almost that you had anyway. So in both examples you gave there, the leader was very clear about, we're going to go into council mode, and then this is what's going to happen. Going to make the decision, or we're then going to do this. Would that be a correct assumption on my part?
Absolutely. It's a great observation, and it's a very correct assumption, right? The more explicit you as a leader can actually get about what the impact of the outcome or what the intent of council mode is, the better.
Otherwise,
because ultimately it could come off as inauthentic, right? I mean, if it's like, hey, I'm going to get everybody's opinion, and by the way, I'm either going to listen to it or not, but I'm not going to tell you, by the way. That kind of goes against the whole trust formula, which, you know, reliability, credibility, and then empathy, but really that empathy is intimacy, which is empathy plus transparency. Those are all the top components of it. So if you're not going to be transparent and you're not going to be potentially reliable in what you're going to do after with the council mode, you will probably run into a problem where people will just stop sharing what they really think in that moment.
Yeah, good. Real good.
All right, guys. Thank you. I appreciate the engagement. This is a great, I think, meaty topic. I think you guys have a lot of fodder for both journals as well as just some experimentation over the next couple weeks, both with telling ourselves a story, selecting your accountability partner if that's the path you choose. We have at least one committed action for that, and then playing around with some of these as experiments. All right, you guys. Thanks for the engagement.
Yeah, drop in San Lo next week. We'll be down there Wednesday.
Perfect. We'll do.
Thanks, bud. Good luck with the move.
All right, thanks. Take care, guys.
Bye.
Bye.